Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps decision on United States v. Scrimeti featuring Aaron Hawley. Our moderator today is Ilya Shapiro. Ilya is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. He's also the author of several books, most recently Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Ilya, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks very much, Marco. Excited to talk so soon after the opinion about this important case. Just a bit of background. This involves a Tennessee law enacted 2 years ago that banned the use of surgical and hormonal medical treatments regarding gender care on minors. Now, three minors, their parents and a doctor, sued on constitutional grounds to block this law. The United States, the Biden administration intervened. The district court granted an injunction holding that transgender individuals constitute a quasi-suspect class, that the Tennessee law discriminates on the basis of sex and transgender status, and that the law was unlikely to survive intermediate scrutiny. The Sixth Circuit reversed, holding that constitutional equal protection claims are unlikely to succeed because the law, Senate Bill 1, SB 1, doesn't classify on the basis of sex. Transgender individuals are not a suspect class, and the law would survive then rational basis scrutiny. And yesterday, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, in a majority opinion written by the Chief Justice, affirmed the Sixth Circuit essentially on the same grounds, basically that it didn't violate the Equal Protection Clause because neither of the law's classifications, age and medical use, are based on sex. And so then it satisfied rational basis. Okay, that's a brief overview. Aaron, let's dig deeper into what this was all about.
Fantastic. So as you said, Ilya, the court distinguishes this case from the arguments made both by the Biden administration and the ACLU. So I think one thing that's sort of important in framing this case is to realize that, as you said, Tennessee and I think 20 some other states have enacted laws to protect minors from potentially life-altering drugs and surgeries. And when Tennessee did this, both the ACLU and the Biden administration sued. The Biden administration intervened under a law that allows them to intervene in equal protection challenges. And they argued that Tennessee could not have this law protecting minors because of two reasons. One, it violated the Equal Protection Clause. And two, transgender status was a protected status under the Constitution. So really sort of the Biden administration setting up this legal battle that results in Scrimeti. And I think many are wondering, you know, whether that was a good move by the Biden administration. So as you said, Ilya, there's basically two ways that the court found the statute in Tennessee classifies. One is based on age. Age, of course, is not a protected characteristic under the Equal Protection Clause. And what the court said is that it's perfectly permissible for Tennessee to limit this procedure to protect minors from these drugs and procedures while allowing them for adults. That doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause. The government, as well as the ACLU, also argued that the statute discriminated based on sex. The court said no. Actually, what it does is it makes distinctions based on medical treatment or medical use. And that, of course, is not a protected class either.
What do you make, or perhaps more importantly, what does the court majority make of Justice Sotomayor's argument in dissent that this is just semantic games to say that this is not a distinction based on sex? Because after all, for example, boys can receive hormones to appear more masculine, but girls cannot receive hormones to appear more masculine.
I think this might be the most important part of the court's decision. And what the majority said is that even when a statute references sex, as is the case that the Sixth Circuit opinion laid out a plethora of statutes that reference sex. And that's, of course, because there are biological differences between men and women. So if we're talking about statutes that protect pregnancy, if we're talking about statutes that touch on subjects like colon cancer or breast cancer or prostate cancer, those statutes often reference sex because of the biological differences between men and women. And what the court said is that just the mere reference of sex in a statute has never been enough to invoke heightened scrutiny. Instead, what you have to look at is if it's actually classifying based on sex. And the court said there was no classification here because the distinction was not the sex of an individual, but rather the purpose of the medical treatment. So a boy could receive drugs, puberty blockers, to prevent precocious puberty or puberty that happens too soon. But that same boy could not receive those drugs for purposes of suppressing hormones and his gender transition procedure. But the same was true. If you change sex, that didn't matter. It was the purpose of the procedure which controlled under the statute.
And what about the dog that didn't bark, Bostock? This is the case several years ago where the court, in an opinion by Justice Gorsuch and also with the chief in the majority there, reading into Title VII employment anti-discrimination law protections for gender identity and sexual orientation. Why did the majority just dismiss that? And Justice Gorsuch didn't even write a concurring opinion to talk about it.
Yeah, super interesting. Justice Gorsuch, of course, often writes concurring opinions. Those have been common out of the court members for quite a while now. But we have no concurrence from Justice Gorsuch, which leaves us all wondering, how far he thinks Bostock goes. What the court was clear about is that Bostock's but-for trigger under Title VII, the court in that case, of course, held that firing someone because of their sexual orientation was but-for cause based on sex. Because if you change that characteristic, that sex characteristic, a female worker would not be fired for her attraction to a man. Yet in this instance, the court said, if it's a male worker that's fired for the attraction to a man, that thing that changes is sex. So it's a but-for cause. The court said even under the Bostock standard in this case, sex was not a but-for cause. Again, what the Tennessee statute focuses on is the purpose of the medical treatment. So boys and girls alike can receive puberty drugs for certain things. But boys and girls alike cannot receive them for other things. So there are boys and girls on both sides of the equation. Interestingly, as you said, Bostock was sort of the dog that didn't bark. And in a lot of areas, the Supreme Court has been trying to bring some sort of uniformity to federal law. If you think about the oral argument in the Medina case, Justice Kavanaugh in particular was wanting or seemed to be wanting to write a clear rule to provide clear direction to the lower courts. But we don't see that here. Instead, the court sort of sidesteps the Bostock issue. We have a number of members of the court writing to say that they would find that Bostock does not apply outside of Title VII, and that it certainly doesn't apply to the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause. But we don't get that ruling from the Supreme Court.
So just to put a finer point on that, what you're saying or what the court was saying is that the hormones, the drugs at issue can't be prescribed for gender dysphoria, but can be for these other medical conditions, regardless of whether the person is the minor is a boy or a girl.
Exactly. And that determination does not depend on sex.
Okay, well, so we didn't have a concurrence from Gorsuch, but we did have three other concurrences from Barrett and Alito. Talk about them.
Sure. So super interesting concurrences. Justice Thomas writes to say that, you know, he thinks Bostock was wrongly decided. So he takes the bull by the horns and says also Bostock would not apply in this situation. Bostock itself, of course, carved out things like bathrooms and locker rooms, said it was only talking about Title VII. And Justice Thomas says that he would clearly hold that Bostock does not apply to the Equal Protection Clause or in constitutional analysis. Of course, the provisions are worded differently, and that matters to an originalist like Justice Thomas. In addition, Justice Thomas would hold that transgender status is not protected. Justice Barrett's opinion really fleshed this out. And I think Justice Barrett's opinion on sort of protected status is super interesting. I think it is sort of an attempt to look at the state of law and describe it in a way that is applicable by the lower courts. She talks about the traditional test that comes out of footnote 4. And she says, you know, it's immutable, political, power, those sorts of things. But she says what she would look at is both immutability, which we know that the gender can be fluid, and that transgender people who change and become transgender also often detransition. So as the oral argument fleshed out, that doesn't really satisfy the immutability requirement for a protected status. And just as Barrett goes on to note that really beyond the, you know, national origin, race, a lineage, the court has not extended protected status. Of course, sex is protected under intermediate scrutiny, but the court has not gone beyond those categories. And she says that she would look only to de jure discrimination, not private discrimination, because that's what should matter for equal protection purposes. So it's a really interesting there. Justice Alito also talks about Bostock and how it shouldn't be extended beyond the Title VII context. And then he really takes the bull by the horns as well on the transgender status and says that is not protected. He sort of quibbles with the majority as to whether if the statute is based on transgender status. He says, you know, you maybe you could read it that way, maybe you can't, but it doesn't matter in this case because transgender status is not protected under the Equal Protection Clause.
Another point of Justice Thomas's concurrence that I found interesting was skepticism of experts. And he said, he explained the, quote, problems with appealing and deferring to the authority of the expert class when evaluating the constitutionality of statutes, and went into a lot of the science, which was more than any other of the writings that we saw, which caught my eye. The brief that I filed for the Manhattan Institute and my colleague, Dr. Lior Sapir, who kind of does studies of these studies, responding to the petitioner's experts. But that, I think Vice President Vance also tweeted out that section of, or he trolled on Blue Sky, I guess, that section of Justice Thomas's concurrence about skepticism of experts.
I think that's a fantastic point, Ilya. And the science was really placed front and center by the Biden administration. In their brief, the Biden administration claimed that these drugs were necessary for children experiencing confusion about their gender. And as we saw after that brief was filed, various reports have come out really questioning whether these procedures have any benefits and highlighting their risks. In fact, the very countries that pioneered these sorts of treatments back in the late 90s have now come to find that they are, for all intents and purposes, banning them for minors and only allowing them in certain limited circumstances. Justice Thomas also pointed out that a number of the experts that the Biden administration and others had relied on or even called the gold standard had some serious problems. I think it's Judge Lagoa's opinion from the 11th Circuit, and she notes that some of these groups are, you know, based on ideology rather than science. So I think an important sort of shot across the bow to say that, number one, it's the state's job to look at these sorts of things. It's not courts. But number two, we especially want to defer to the states when we have types of procedures like these, which are very risky and being imposed on our very vulnerable and youngest children.
One little practice tip that I found from the discussion of the international studies, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was very hot to discuss the use of foreign sources and foreign law and constitutional interpretation. Justices Breyer and Scalia did a bit of a roadshow on this. And I thought that it might be nice to point out that here, when you're talking about not legal interpretation, you know, we're not looking at what England or Holland or Norway, how they interpret their due process protections or anything like that, or equal protection. But you know, medical studies, because humans are humans, and so to the extent medical studies are relevant, and the chief disclaims that his decision is based on where the science leads, that's for a separate discussion. But just a practice note that I don't think invoking these studies is the same thing as invoking, you know, foreign courts' determinations of facially parallel legal principles. All right. What about the dissent? Anything else notable on the dissents before we turn to audience questions?
So I think one thing, the dissent, you know, raises a bunch of hypotheticals, and those are the key and oral arguments, as well as the dissent. And I think the majority does a good job of distinguishing those situations. And also just, again, coming back to the point that the mere fact that a statute references sex does not make it discriminatory. And I think this is really key. The court did not go into, you know, details or really forecast how this would apply to bathrooms or sports or those sorts of things. But I think its underlying premise that sex, that biology matters, really does say something about those things. And as Justice Ginsburg said long ago, you know, there are immutable differences, that there are reasons to celebrate, that there are differences for men and women. And I think that kind of forms the core of this court's opinion, and shows that some distinctions based on sex are permissible, not discrimination.
Notably, Justice Kagan just said that this is subject to heightened scrutiny and would have ended it there, remanding for further evaluation. All right, let's go to audience questions. The first one from Tom Palmer asks, is there another case brewing on gender surgery as opposed to just drug therapy? Because, of course, originally surgery was challenged as well, but that fell away on standing ground. So there could still be a challenge on gender surgery.
There certainly could. I think the, you know, again, to the extent that the medical studies are relevant, probably not a lot because we defer to the legislature. I think that that case might even be easier than this one, because with surgeries, you are talking about life altering treatments that can cause all sorts of things from cancer to permanent infertility. And so it seems in line with the decision, perfectly reasonable for a state to restrict those sorts of surgeries to minors. So I'd be surprised if we see that challenge, but you're correct that it wasn't directly presented in this case.
Ernie Trakas asks, what are your thoughts on Justice Alito's concurring opinion? Let's do another beat on that, because he said, well, you know, maybe it's subject to heightened scrutiny. Maybe it is a protected class. And his point that the court should have specifically addressed the question because, quote, if we do not confront it now, we will almost certainly be required to do so very soon.
I think that point is well taken. I think in this opinion, you see one that's fairly narrow. It's narrow on the Bostock question. It's narrow on the question of whether transgender status is protected. You see three justices writing, I think on both of those, to say that they would find Bostock does not apply outside of Title VII. And you see justices also Barrett, joined by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, saying that transgender status is not protected. But absolutely a good point that those questions are, you know, certainly to come up through the lower courts and very near certainly going to need to be resolved by the Supreme Court.
That dovetails directly into our next question from Professor Greg Dolan, who's both a JD and an MD, so might have a unique perspective here. But anyway, he asks to follow up on the Justice Barrett concurrence, which he says in some sense seemed to be the most conservative one, because she would just say this wasn't a suspect class, there are no further suspect classes. And interesting politically, because she's being criticized by some for having shifted or not having a jurisprudence or being disappointment or whatever, and here she is making, you know, the going further than the majority. So why do you think that only Justice Thomas joined that?
So I'm not sure why only Justice Thomas joined that. I think it could be that I think it is an innovation in the law. Her questions at oral argument also focused on this idea of whether there's been private discrimination or whether there's been discrimination in the law or de jure discrimination. And so she was focused on that from oral argument on. And in her view, her opinion sets out that this would be a much more administrable standard for the lower courts to apply. In addition, as this, you know, the question alluded to, she obviously set a very high bar for protected classes in general. And I suspect, you know, most, if not all of the conservative justices agree with that. I don't know whether they would go a little bit further and say that it's only de jure discrimination that is involved. I think that makes sense when you're looking at the sort of original meaning of the provision. But maybe it's just a little bit of a nuance that the court's other members didn't want to sign on to in a concurrence.
Since we're doing follow-ups on the concurrences, I'll go to an anonymous attendee who asks, what are the potential implications from Justice Thomas's concurrence about science and expert consensus beyond these transgender and medical issues?
Sure. So I think we've seen this in a number of different cases where the justices are sort of saying, you know, we're not going to engage in this battle of experts, of medical experts. If you think about the different medical associations, WPATH, as different opinions have pointed out, seems to have an ideological bent. They were concerned when their studies might not support, you know, the removal of age limitations for drugs and surgeries. And so I think this is the court recognizing that medical professionals are not devoid of their own ideological persuasions. And sometimes, if not often, that comes into their opinions. In addition, I think even the more fundamental point is when you have a debated issue of medical treatment or the like, those are the things that are typically left to the state legislatures. All of the opinions really focused on that. And they also talked about medical ethics and the medical ethics here of, you know, giving a child a drug or procedure that many countries have found to pose more risks than potential benefits, that's something for states to regulate. So I think a shift from sort of relying on the expert elites to a shift to trusting the democratic process a bit more.
Well, a question about Chief Justice Roberts, for whom you clerked, so maybe you have some insight into his thinking. John Scheller asks, why did he keep the case for himself? Why did he write it rather than assigning to someone else? Was it to avoid a bolder decision by Thomas or Alito or Barrett, as we just discussed?
You know, it's hard to know. You're always speculating when you make those sorts of calls, but it's obviously an important decision. And so the assigning justice, you know, has first dibs at those. And if you look at the opinion, I think he does strike a balance. Like, he relies on the medical evidence to show that the government's representations are not necessarily accurate. But he also points out that's not something that courts typically rely on. Instead, they look to the Democratic branches to resolve those disputes. So in keeping the opinion, he's able to make those sort of nuanced decisions. The opinion is also, of course, sympathetic to youth who struggle with these sorts of issues. We know children who are confused about their gender often suffer other mental health afflictions or conditions. And so he writes it, I think, in a way that is sympathetic to those individuals, while also clearly laying out that states have the authority and power to protect them.
Jeffrey Wood asks, do we think that Scrimeti will result in Bostock being confined to its facts, even if only tacitly?
That is a great question, and I don't think we know. We have several concurrences saying they think Bostock should be limited to Title VII. There's even arguments that it should be limited to hiring and firing decisions under Title VII. We have several justices saying it clearly doesn't apply to the Equal Protection Clause. That's a different provision. Many of those same arguments would apply to Title IX. It's a different provision. It uses different language. It has different statutory history. But I think that's one big question coming out. It's clear that no one is, you know, using Bostock to expand protections. At Bostock, it found that they did not apply here, that the but-for test is narrow. But whether that but-for test might apply in other situations, I think is a question for another day.
The fact that Justice Gorsuch didn't write separately tells me that at least he doesn't think that it goes much more broadly. And he's the ur-textualist or the hyper-textualist to his critics. So,
or at least he doesn't want to tell us now.
Right, right.
He was completely silent in oral argument here. So
That's true. He was, wasn't he? Yeah. No writing, no questions. Very interesting. Beyond Bostock, an anonymous attendee says, what does this mean going forward? Has this set precedent? Well, obviously it's set precedent, but what does it mean? Somebody else asked me yesterday, does it force a reconsideration of the grim line of precedent about, schools have to have accommodate transgender individuals in the bathroom of their choice and things like that?
So I think it indicates that biological sex and distinctions based on biological sex are often permissible. Obviously this is an equal protection case. So those sorts of claims based on the Equal Protection Clause will have a much harder time. You've also got Title IX, and a lot of the Title IX challenges have been made to bathrooms, to sports, those sorts of things. And I don't think the court's opinion squarely addresses those, but I do think the sort of recognition that biological sex matters and making a distinction is not always discrimination will be really helpful to those cases going forward.
Couple of questions are looking ahead to see whether this precedent means anything for a case next term, Childs v. Salazar. To what degree does this case affect challenges to state laws banning conversion therapy? Teresa Collette mentions this is the Christian counselor case.
Sure. So, and a bit of a disclosure here, the firm I work for, Alliance Defending Freedom, represents Casey Childs in that case. She's a counselor, a person of faith who wants to counsel in line with that. And the Colorado law here is really just blatantly viewpoint-based. It says that a counselor in Colorado can offer affirming counseling, they cannot counsel someone who's transgender to being comfortable with their own body. And just a quick aside here, but I think that the science and the writing, I read a New York Times article today that was even recognizing this, or maybe it was the Free Press. But the reality is that if children before puberty who are confused about their gender, if parents and society adopt a sort of wait and see approach, the vast majority of those children become comfortable with their genders once they go through puberty. So I think that's really a key fact here for really looking at how best to help those kids. But to transition back to your question about Childs, it's certainly true that Scrimeti notes that these sort of debated medical decisions are up to the states in large measure if they're not based on a protected class. I think the difference in Childs is that the counseling Casey provides is purely speech. It's only speech. There's no medical treatment. And the court obviously has announced different rules for speech. It's protected under the First Amendment. So I think that's the key distinction between Scrimeti and Childs.
And I just filed a brief in Childs representing Jewish and Muslim therapists on a religious exercise perspective. I found that a very interesting exercise to go through. Childs is shaping up thus far to be the biggest case of next term, but I'm sure they'll add some others. Getting to a kind of a technical jurisprudential point now, Justice Alito and Barrett ultimately agree that transgenderism or transgender status is not a protected class, but differ in their analysis. What compare and contrast their approaches?
So I'm sorry, Elliot, could you repeat that?
Justice Alito and Barrett both agree that transgender status or transgenderism is not a protected class, but they get there in different ways. Compare and contrast, and what is the significance of that difference?
Sure. So Justice Barrett has an interesting footnote in her concurrence in which she notes that she views Justice Alito's decision as being consistent with her own, or I should say concurrence as being consistent with her own, but with slightly different emphases. And I think that's probably right. As we discussed, Justice Barrett focuses more sort of on the de jure. Justice Alito, as he did in oral argument, really focuses on this fact of immutability, as he forced the lawyers representing the ACLU to admit transgender status is not immutable because many individuals choose to detransition. Even the medical literature talks about gender being sort of fluid. And as we discussed, many children who suffer from gender confusion, if you allow them to go through puberty, actually become comfortable with their own gender that's consistent with their sex. So Justice Alito sort of more focusing on the traditional standards. Justice Barrett does that, but then she also shifts to this idea that it needs to be de jure discrimination.
Elizabeth Kirk asks, some have thought the court might be moving away from the tiers of scrutiny analysis, but this case doubles down on it. So your thoughts on the future of scrutiny land, as it's been called by some?
Sure. I think that's a great question from Elizabeth. And I think there's a couple of interesting things. Another thing that's been really sort of bubbling about, certainly in the literature and in the court Second Amendment decisions, is, you know, how much do we look to history and tradition? There were a gob of briefs filed on the sort of original understanding, original meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. And that really doesn't feature that prominently in the Supreme Court's cases. So question whether that will you know, be of lesser importance in the Equal Protection Clause. I think the same thing is true to Elizabeth's question about the tiers of scrutiny. I think, you know, tiers of scrutiny are rightly questioned. They're a relatively new sort of judicial innovation. But as other justices and scholars have pointed out, there were these sort of exceptions even way back in history. You had a rule, but then there were exceptions to it, which looks a little bit like strict scrutiny. And then I think the really practical question, which is likely driving many members of the Supreme Court, is just what do we replace it with? And so at least as this opinion indicates, that the court is maybe weighing in on, like, we're just going to stick with what we know, even if we had it to do all over again, it might look a little differently.
Michael Russell asks, what effect do you think this decision will have in states where similar laws were passed but maybe struck down on state constitutional grounds? Are there any factual determinations that could be considered binding or any other way to get those, I guess, into the Supreme Court from state Supreme Courts?
That's a really good question. Of course, the state courts can have different equal protection interpretations. And so it would potentially be possible for a state court that has one of So you could have a statute that protects transgender status. That's probably unlikely in a state that would also have a law that protects minors. So the most likely way for one of these sorts of decisions to arise would be for the state court to find that is protected under the state constitution. That, of course, the state courts are in large free to do. However, I do think that the look at the science here, sort of the critical look at what other countries are doing, the recognition that they are finding that these procedures are risks outweigh the benefits, while not binding, I think will give pause to courts sort of assessing these sorts of issues under state constitution. But again, not directly applicable, but it seems like both the public opinion as well as the bulk of the body of the scientific evidence is weighing in favor of at least waiting until children can make their own decisions once they've hit puberty past the age of 18.
Sticking with areas of state concern, state development, an anonymous attendee notes that many states and local school districts are sorting out what to do about gender identity implications on bathrooms, locker rooms, sports participation. What, if any, are the implications of Scrimeti on those issues?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. I think the court is clear that these sorts of issues are by and large up to the legislature. So you see a lot of deference to the state legislatures as they work through those sorts of decisions. In addition, I think if you are thinking about Title IX, then you've got the question of whether Bostock applies. Yeah, I think this decision indicates probably not, but we don't know. But we do know, and again, I really do, I said this several times, but I think the core of the decision is the Supreme Court's recognition that biological distinctions can matter, and recognizing that is not necessarily discrimination.
And so if it's left to the legislature, what about the federal legislature? Ernie Trakas asks, do you see Chief Justice Roberts' statement that, quote, questions regarding the law's policy are thus appropriately left to the people, their elected representatives, and the democratic process, unquote, as an indication or implication that the definition or redefinition of sex, and I'll add gender, gender identity, all these sorts of things, is up to Congress, not the court?
So I don't think so. I think the question would be, you know, what sex meant when the original provision was enacted. That said, Congress could, of course, enact a statute that protects gender identity. And then that would, the court would be faced with that statute. But I think for present purposes, you would need to look at the original understanding. Congress, of course, could do something else in the future. And then the court would need to look at the text of that statute. So potentially, but it would have to be a new statute.
Here's an important question that we sort of answered, but it's important to emphasize, I think. CJ Wallace asks, what would the grounds be for transgenders or transgender people being a protected class?
Okay, and one caveat to the first, the question I just answered, that would be as a statutory basis. I don't think Congress can change the constitutional meaning of sex. So, sure. And then in terms of transgender status, I think we don't have a lot to go on what the court is thinking, but we do have the concurrences from both Justice Alito and Justice Barrett. And both of those, I think, very consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, set a really high bar for that. The court points out, Justice Barrett points out, that there's only a few categories that are protected, and that the court has rejected all sorts of them. The elderly, the disabled, the poor, none of those have been awarded this super protected status under the Equal Protection Clause.
And what are the criteria? I mean, there's immutability, there's what, history of state-based discrimination?
Yes, and then sort of political powerlessness. And Justice Barrett really takes issue with this political powerlessness thing. She thinks that is sort of open-ended and sort of in the eye of the beholder. So she would focus more on de jure discrimination.
Okay. Here's an interesting question. John Scheller asks, the Trump administration switched sides substantively in a letter, but did not withdraw the U.S. brief or seek to dismiss or seek to reposition itself on the other side. Why and how did the court deal with that?
Sure. So oral argument had already taken place. It's very common in the change of administration for a court, for an administration to let the court know that it's changed sides. A letter is the standard way for doing so. Now, the questioner is correct that in some instances, the United States will actually withdraw its briefs or submit new briefing. Here, they didn't do so. This is a total speculation, but I think one reason might be that they were comfortable with the way oral argument proceeded, and they hoped the court would proceed to judgment. In this case, that probably would have happened anyway, because you did have the ACLU as separate and still adverse. But my guess is they didn't think it was necessary. But a good question. The court, or the administration, certainly could have done that.
Jake New asks, how persuasive do you find the majority opinion's attempt to distinguish SB1, the Tennessee law, as not being based on transgender status? Perhaps I should have used this as a follow-up to the previous question. But anyway, Alito appears to find it unpersuasive, and the ACLU and other progressive commentators speaking on the case yesterday widely criticized this part of the ruling, but also noted that it limits the scope of the ruling. What do you make of that?
So I You know, personally, I think a more straightforward approach might have been the one suggested by Justice Alito, just to find that transgender status is not protected for all the reasons that he and Justice Barrett, joined by Justice Thomas, mentioned. Transgender status or individuals discrimination doesn't seem to meet those statutory criteria, as oral argument demonstrated. I think that the chief mentions that it doesn't even discriminate based on transgender status because some transgender individuals don't want the drugs or procedures. So there's transgender individuals on both sides of it. Justice Alito says, well, maybe, but there's a decent argument, and so we should just decide the issue. I think there's some force to that. But ultimately, I think the court got the 6 votes here. And so maybe that was what was at issue here.
Here's a really nerdy question that I'll throw in, mm-hmm. since we've been discussing Justice Alito and Barrett's opinions. What do you make of their dueling footnotes on alienage and how aliens are treated or not as protected classes?
I have to confess that I have not, I did not dive that deeply into those footnotes.
We've reached the end.
Yes, sorry. I note that Justice Barrett did point out in the text of her opinion, that alienage has always been considered a protected status. And so I look forward to diving into that more.
Here's a kind of broader philosophical question. C.J. Wallace asks, should justices be concerned about democratic processes when they have been tasked to rule on the law? Why are democratic processes even brought up?
So if I understand the question, I think it's just this idea that the legislature is typically viewed as more competent to weigh competing concerns. Here we have procedures that are directed at children who, in many cases, can't smoke, they can't drive, they can't consume alcohol, they can't vote. And so that the state is typically thought to be in the best position to weigh those sorts of concerns. As the opinion points out, medical ethics is traditionally a province of those state legislatures. And I think that's really in contrast to the courts. When we're talking about the Constitution, when we're talking about the Equal Protection Clause or the Due Process Clause, on spades or steroids, then you're really talking about the court taking those sorts of decisions away from the elected branches without a lot of recourse, unless there's a constitutional amendment, which we all know is really difficult. So I think the court is basically saying, the institutional competencies of the legislature are much more suited to these sorts of questions. The Constitution doesn't say anything, and it's not a good idea to constitutionalize most things in any event.
What if where the court might have to make those judgment calls, even on science, say, like if something is subject to strict scrutiny, this is why some people criticize the scrutiny rubric, but if something is subject to strict scrutiny and you have, which of course requires a law to survive, to be narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest, and you have dueling experts with dueling medical studies, and the court has to decide which medical studies, I guess, are more compelling or what have you.
Yeah, I think that's one reason that the classes protected are fairly narrow, because once you do get to strict scrutiny, not only is it very hard for a state to uphold the law, but then you get all these sorts of questions that mire the courts in them. So absolutely agree.
An anonymous attendee asks, even though the question wasn't granted cert, might petitioners have had a case under substantive due process, specifically the rights of parents to make medical decisions for their children?
So that's a really interesting question, and the cases are percolating in the lower courts about, what precisely do parental rights look like in this situation. I think probably the key distinction here is that there's never been a right of either an individual or of a parent to choose a medical treatment that is illegal. So they could have raised the claim. Ultimately, I think that would depend on the court's finding that there's this right to an illegal treatment, which seems perhaps a bridge too far.
Well, there's one more question about from Jeffrey Wood on the dissent's treatment of science, or did they rely on the science at all? Was that the dispute? It doesn't seem like they were. I think it was purely a legal argument about protected classes and scrutiny, right?
I think that's right. And I think that shows just how much this argument shifted from when the Biden administration intervened in this case to when the case was decided. Like, we had the CAS report come out. All of these nations are really walking back this idea that these drugs and procedures should be given to minors. And I think if this were, you know, a year and a half ago, that dissent might have looked a lot different. But today, there's sort of both relevant sort of revelations about sort of some of the science the Biden administration and others were relying on, as well as this recognition that we don't have good studies, and the studies that we do have show that it's very risky and that the potential benefits may not be there.
At that point, might warrant a shout out to our friend Eddie LaCour, the Solicitor mm-hmm. General of Alabama, for getting discovery in parallel litigation that disclosed the politicization of the science, WPATH, and otherwise. Well, I think that's all. One question here. That's an interesting one. Critics of this decision argue that the logic of the opinion applied to Loving versus Virginia, of course, which struck down an anti-miscegenation law, would have led to a different result in that case. Can you explain why this opinion is consistent with Loving?
Sure. So I think the Chief Justice, I believe it's in the majority opinion, takes that argument on and says it's in the context of, you know, every distinction based on sex is not discrimination. So if you build that hypothetical out, you know, every distinction based on race is not necessarily discrimination. So I think that's what the questioner is asking and what the dissent was saying with Loving versus Virginia. But I think the chief's response, which is spot on, is, well, there is no reason would even fail rational basis review, but certainly that there would be no reason to distinguish between which races can marry. So it would be pretextual and invidious discrimination. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Here, there's all sorts of reasons that the Tennessee legislature gave for why they wanted to protect children. As the court noted in Loving, really, that the only thing they could find justifying it there was a sort of idea of white supremacy, which the court, of course, disavowed. So I think that satisfactorily aligns both of those cases.
All right, let's end on this. The Chief Justice has said that there are no Trump judges or Biden judges. I think he said actually there are no Trump judges or Obama judges. That this was before Biden was president. But John Scheller says this is naive in light of how the cases are coming down in recent years. I'll just say some of the more politically salient ones, perhaps. There's still a high rate of unanimity otherwise. But he says there really are Trump and Biden judges, aren't there?
So I honestly don't think so. And, you know, to go back to something you just said, Ilya, it's actually been reported there's a wide degree of unanimity on this current court, even though they've had some really hot button cases. Still, in the vast majority of them, they're 7-2, 8-1, 9-0 decisions. So I think each of the justices do their level best to apply the law, to use their view of constitutional interpretation. And, you know, there's differences certainly among those constitutional interpretation methods, and we can debate which is the best and the worst. But you see odd ideological alignments all the time. And so I don't think that would be accurate.
Great. I think that's all. That's a good note to end on. Do you have any other concluding thoughts about this case or what this signals for the court going forward or for this area of litigation?
So again, I think it's both a huge monumental decision, allowing states to protect some of their most vulnerable minors. But I do think it leaves several questions for tomorrow. And so would expect this issue to continue to be litigated in the lower courts and quite potentially at the Supreme Court.
Great. With that, we will conclude this. If you missed some of this discussion or your friends want to see it later, it'll be posted typically within a few days, although these are coming hot and heavy at the end of term, of course. So it might take FedSoc a little bit, but I want to thank Aaron for the insight and the deep dive, and to the Federal Society for hosting these interesting discussions. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.